Steve Fast with you on WJBC on Monday, May 4th, 1970. The Ohio National Guard came into conflict with student protesters on the campus of Kent State University. As tensions escalated, the guardsmen fired 67 rounds into the group of protesters, and four students were killed. Nine were wounded, including one man who was paralyzed. Joining us is Howard Means. In his book, 67 Shots, Kent State and the End of American Innocence, the author tells the story of the events that led to that shooting and sent shockwaves across America and the aftermath of the ugly incident from a turbulent time. Howard, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it very much.
So it's been 46 years, so people that are not old enough at the time of the Kent State shooting to remember it as it happened might not be so sure what the protest was about. And even those of us that were around might only have a fuzzy idea and remember only that it was tied to Vietnam. What was the circumstance that brought these student protesters out that day?
Well, there's sort of a big picture and a tighter focus picture. The big picture is the 1960s. And again, the age group you were just talking about probably has a fairly slim sense of the 1960s, but it was the huge generational divide caused by the Vietnam War, caused by the Civil Rights Movement. I call it the age of hate in the book, and it was in many ways the age of hate. Just the families split apart generationally by the war because they're, you know, the fathers, a lot of these fathers had served in World War II in Korea, and they couldn't understand. So that was the whole sort of backdrop to the thing. The foreground really picks up on the Thursday before April 30th. Richard Nixon, a couple of weeks earlier, had announced a drawdown of about 150,000 troops from Vietnam on Thursday, the evening of Thursday, April 30th, in an address to the nation. He announced that instead the drawdown was being suspended and the war instead was being expanded over the border into Cambodia, the western border of Vietnam into Cambodia. In fact, U.S. troops have been operating in Cambodia for over a year, but to the people at home, to the students, this was a breach of faith on Nixon's part. There were a lot of protests the next day, and Kent State was one of the places those protests happened. But for a whole variety of circumstances, which we can get into, things got completely out of control quickly at Kent State.
So was the general temperature for student protests similar everywhere? Was Kent State and the student activist movement on that campus in any way unique?
It wasn't unique, no. It was surprising to a lot of people because while Kent State was a school of 21,000 people, it was basically a regional school. There was still, in many ways, its primary job in many ways was still to prepare high school teachers, public school teachers for Northeast Ohio. So there was this sort of, you know, it was a big, big campus. It was under the radar, but there had been a lot of student protest activity there. The Students for Democratic Society had a very active chapter there until the end of late 1969 when it was suspended, when the charter was revoked. So it wasn't a unique campus in that regard. What made it unique were the couple things. One, there was a huge town-gown divide. The school had simply outgrown the community. It scared a lot of the people. The people in Kent were expecting the worst. And when there was some minor, when there was bad behavior downtown on Friday night by a lot of students, in some cases criminal behavior, but to a lot of people in Kent, it confirmed the worst, that, you know, that the onslaught had begun, the revolution was there, and the mayor of the town overreacted to what was really, it was the first warm weekend in spring, there was too much beer involved, there was too much everything involved, and the Vietnam War protests sparked by the Nixon address the night before made matters sort of more volatile than they might have been otherwise. But in the middle of the wee hours of the morning, the mayor called Governor Jim Rhodes' office, the Ohio governor, and first inquired about the National Guard and mentioned that Students for a Democratic Society had been behind a lot of the protests downtown. And those two factors took it to another level.
Well, I want to talk about Governor Jim Rhodes and how he used the National Guard in a way and his reaction to this for his own political ends in just a second. But by the time the governor was asked to assist in this, we should probably talk about the moments of escalation, because there were tensions that led up to men with guns being called in and being on edge. Only a few days before what happened with the shooting, there was an ROTC building that was burned down.
Yep. And it was not uncommon to burn down ROTC buildings or to try to burn them down on American campuses in the late 60s. It was the most, you know, it was the most visible symbol on campus of American military power. And in many cases, they were buildings easy to light on fire. They, you know, wooden structures that had gone up in a hurry in World War II. Often they were sort of off on the edge of campus, too, so they didn't present a fire hazard to a lot of other buildings. But all that said, it should have been perfectly obvious to the administration of Kent State University that this building was a target. And there was a sign Friday. The building is lit on fire Saturday night and burns to the ground. But on Friday, there had been a sign on campus, prominently displayed on campus, why is the ROTC building still standing? And 24 hours later, a little more than 24 hours later, it wasn't standing anymore. But the university made no attempt to protect the building. Even when firefighters showed up from the city of Kent, and there, in some cases, again, in four or five instances, their hoses, their fire hoses, were attacked with machetes and other knives, picks, ice picks, that sort of thing. And there was a campus police force. There was a 30-person campus police force that made no attempt to intervene and protect it. So the university consistently sent the wrong signal to students and consistently, I think, made the wrong choices.
We're talking with Howard Means. His book, 67 Shots, is about the Kent State clash between the Ohio National Guard and student protesters, which led to a shooting, including four fatalities. So, Howard, let's get back a little bit to the political ambitions of Ohio Governor Jim Rhodes and how he used this moment to essentially try to help his own campaign. He was leaving the governor's mansion and he was running for, I believe, Senate.
Right.
And at the time, you know, a lot of voters were uneasy about these student protests, uneasy about the disruption of order. What did Governor Rhodes decide to do, and what were his motivations?
Well, Jim Rhodes was a law and order governor, Republican law and order governor, had fairly high national standing. He was very much in the mode of Ronald Reagan out in California, who had made his reputation as a law and order governor out there, standing up to student protesters at places like Berkeley, UCal Berkeley. So Jim Rhodes is locked in a tight senatorial primary campaign. The primary election is scheduled for Tuesday, May 5. He gets this request in the early morning hours of Saturday, May 2, or this inquiry about bringing the National Guard to Kent. From his point of view, logistically, it was easy because there was already a National Guard unit involved in trying to broker the Teamsters strike in Akron, just about 10, 15 miles away. And Jim Rhodes' natural constituency was this sort of southern Ohio Republicans, and he wanted to activate his base, just like, you know, politicians today want to activate their base. This gave him a chance to do it. He had the guard nearby. He orders the guard to come to Kent. The guard itself declares that it's only going to come if it can marshal law in both Kent and the campus. So on Saturday night, Jim Rhodes and his opponent, Robert Taft Jr., son of Robert Taft, the famous Mr. Republican, have their last debate. Jim Rhodes is trailing. When that debate gets underway, he's trailing in the polls by about 70,000 votes. On Tuesday, when the election is held, he loses by 5,000 votes. So he did activate his base by doing this, and he darn near carried it all the way to the Senate Republican primary. I mean, to the Senate Republican nomination for the seat. So it served Jim Rhodes' purposes beautifully to have this happen. The problem is that the guard came in such massive force that by Sunday afternoon, the students were no longer protesting the Vietnam War. They were protesting the fact that their campus had been taken over by the National Guard. And that's really what sets the stage for the horror of Monday.
What's kind of ironic and interesting about the National Guard and the actual guardsmen that would come in into conflict with these protesters is, at the time, some people joined the National Guard to try and avoid service in Vietnam. So I'm sure it wasn't the case for
the National Guard.
Right. I'm sure it wasn't the case for every guardsman that was right on duty that day, but you have the National Guard essentially brought in over the fear of protesters protesting Vietnam, and the Guard is consisting of several people that joined the National Guard so they wouldn't have to go to Vietnam. It's a weird irony.
It's a weird irony, and on Sunday, after the Guard arrives while the ROTC building's burning on Saturday, There's a big confrontation later that evening at the main gates of the university. But by Sunday, things had settled down, and everybody talks about it having almost a beach party atmosphere in lots of cases. There are wonderful photographs of the guards and the students, you know, talking, sharing cigarettes, etc. And it looked for a while there that it was going to be, you know, everything would sort of peter out. The students would go back to being students. The guards would go back to, you know, to their jobs, in some cases being students, school teachers, whatever they were. But then there's another huge confrontation on Sunday night, again at these gates. And by then, the guard is in such mass. And on Sunday night, they're just helicopters flying all over the place, dropping tear gas in some cases, shining spotlights down. And it just militarized. It militarized a civilian disturbance. And ultimately, a military solution got applied because these guardsmen are equipped basically for crowd control with M1 battle rifles, lethal to half a mile, with bayonets and with tear gas. So there's no sort of middle ground. There are no rubber bullets. There are no water cannons, the sort of things you saw elsewhere at that point. So the stage was set for Monday afternoon, and with tragic results.
Well, what's more, I think the fact that the guardsmen were not equipped with, as you say, with rubber bullets or mm-hmm. other non-lethal ways to handle this other than tear gas, they weren't necessarily equipped with training.
Yeah, they were poorly trained. They were horribly led on Monday. There's just no other word for it. The mission commander is a guy named Brigadier General Robert Canterbury, and Canterbury, just at every chance he got, he made the wrong choice. He tried to disperse the students, and he read the Ohio Riot Act, or he had it read to them. He tried to disperse the students. He drove them up the hill and down the other side, and of course they came together again once they got dispersed, and now they're in another crowd. He marches his men down into a cul-de-sac, a practice field with a wire fence on two sides of it. He discovers when he gets down there that he's out of tear gas. Why he discovers it then, when the stock of tear gas was well known before they left their staging ground. So he orders a retreat, basically, back up the hill. The students are following him. The students realize they're retreating. They think they've won. They follow him. They're taunting them, and in some cases, they're throwing rocks at the guardsmen. That's probably criminal behavior, but it's not a capital offense. It's not a capital offense to taunt. It's not a capital offense to give the finger to guardsmen. But about two-thirds of the way up the hill, 27 or so of the guardsmen turn and start firing into the crowd. And I think in a lot of cases, the guardsmen inside their gas masks thought there was a riot going on. They thought they were going to be overrun by students. I pity the guardsmen in many ways. I didn't think I would when I was starting out in the book, but I felt really badly for them. As one guardsman said in an interview, that it's almost as if we were put on that hill to fail. And I think that's really what happened to them. And I think a number of them still feel, you know, the pain of that moment. But inside their gas mask and the world they were inhabiting, they had 3 hours sleep. They simply panicked and in some cases began firing into the crowd.
Do we know at all what sparked the first shot to be fired? Was it just a moment of panic? There was no order necessarily given, right?
There's no order given to fire that I know. Some people think they discern it in some tapes that have come to light recently. My best guess as to what happened is that a small number of guardsmen turned, fired a volley over the heads of students to discourage them, to push them back, and other guardsmen, hearing their comrades fire, didn't realize they were firing above the crowd and turned and fired into the crowd. So I think it was terrible miscommunication, fatal miscommunication in four instances. That question will, I don't think, ever be answered, because the people who could now answer it are dead.
Well, not all that long ago, we have seen the paramilitary reaction to a fear of protest and riot in places like Ferguson. We've seen incidents of conflicts between authority and young unarmed people that has resulted in some fatalities. Do you see any echoes of the incident at Kent State in what's happened?
Yeah, absolutely I do. I think in those same cases, you have, again, the militarization, the military response to a civilian disturbance. And so, as had happened at Kent, when the police force shows up in Ferguson or shows up in Baltimore, really, you know, armed to the teeth by a Pentagon, surplus Pentagon program that has equipped them with equipment, firepower, and other equipment basically designed to go door-to-door in Kabul, it turns it automatically into a much bigger problem than it was initially. It militarizes it. It brings to the fore anger that wasn't there before. It draws in, as happened at Kent State, It draws people into the fray who otherwise wouldn't have gotten drawn into it. And it just ratchets everything up to a perilous level. Again, when you're equipped with semi-automatic and automatic rifles, it's just so easy to fire off, 16, 20, 25 rounds in no time at all, that you really, your first instinct is to spray bullets instead of finding other solutions.
Howard Means is the author of 67 Shots, Kent State, and the End of American Innocence, talking with us about this incident, which happened 46 years ago this upcoming May 4th, this week. Howard, thanks for taking some time to chat with us this morning.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you, Steve.